an alcoholic. So we're at step two. And just to let you know that my home group is the Georgetown Big Book step study meeting. We meet on Saturday mornings. So if you're going to Logan Airport and you want to stop, we make the best coffee, 8:30 to 9:45. Love to have you. So when I was with my sponsor, just to give you an idea, I was the first 13 years of my marriage, I was drinking. So I stopped at year 13 and then came into Alcoholics Anonymous, had that moment of, insanity. And so now I'm working, it's 1999, and I'm working with Lisa, and we're reading, step two. So more about alcoholism outlines beautifully the thinking part of the whole disease model. So when we hear about the man, he brings out his carpet slippers, and that was my dad. You know, it was so incredible when I read that for the first time. Because both parents were drinkers, but my dad stopped and just kind of was white-knuckling it until he retired. And when he retired, he didn't live long before he died. And it's sad. It's sad to think that, he's a no-named man in the big book, but he was my dad. And so then we have Jim and we have Fred. And so Lisa said, Mary, I want you to pay attention to the italicized words because they're very, very important. Suddenly the thought crossed my mind. And she said, you will leave here never being the same person because we're going to think about every thought. You know, and spiritually you can find, biblically, hold your thoughts captive. And here I am with her and, Jim, Fred, the jaywalker, they all had this thought that crossed their mind that it was a good idea to do what? Well, put an ounce of whiskey in my drink or, to take up with a taxi cab guy and just tout around Washington and drinking. So she said, okay, we're going to look at your thinking. And suddenly the thought crosses your mind. And she was very, very generous, as I said, sharing her experience with her life. She had multiple husbands. And I'm still, fighting with the one that I have, right? And God bless him. Scott, I love you if you ever hear this. And we just celebrated our 38th wedding anniversary. So we're good. But at the time, my thinking was, how I can possibly, get this degree, work with Lisa, and then move out, So those are the thoughts that are going through my mind. And she said, Mary, you need to, harness that thought and let it go and bring in a God thought. So, this whole more about alcoholism was about my crazy thinking. The thinking that I was obsessed with from the earliest days, when I was a young girl. And I was obsessed with, boys from sixth grade on. I was obsessed with being in the right group with the right people so people would think well of me. I was upset. My thinking was obsessed with all these outside things, nothing interiorly, which contributed to the shallowness of who I was when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so what she wanted me to do is to came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So the insanity was outlined, and we read, there is a solution. How beautiful is that, It's just like a shot of, holiness right through your veins that, we're gonna find a God. We're going to be rocketed. Things are going to be good. And, but it was that thinking. So how do I go from this obsessed oppressed woman who is, you know, have... George mentioned, it's George, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. mentioned being a type A. I'm a type A too, firstborn. You know, everything lists, you know, have check off all the boxes. But came to believe that God could restore me, and he's going to restore the way I think. And she said, well, we're going to begin with it one day at a time, one thought at a time, one moment at a time. And so when I left her house, she said, I want you to begin on the ride home to pull your thoughts, hold your thoughts captive, and then let them go, and then invite a God thought. It was the hottest thing I ever did. It was exhausting. I didn't even want to think. I had a headache, you know? And but the point was to identify alcoholic thinking. And if I could identify it, then I could begin to have this love relationship with God and invite God to help me restore my thinking, then perhaps the insanity would begin to change. So I had stopped the relationship outside of my marriage. I'm focused in with the four children, trying to live a life, you know, worthy of my marriage vows, and trying to hold my thoughts captive. And I believed in a power. I was churched, right? I was raised in the church, the Catholic Church, as a little girl. You know, and I was such a chameleon, you know, so it began early. So I was ripe for taking on whatever it was that I was taking on, or whoever was in my arena. And when I got married, well, before we got married, I married an Italian man, and I just assumed he was Catholic. I don't know, all Italians Catholic, you know, like that assuming thing. And so we were at a party, and I said, what? You're not Italian? You're not Catholic? I said, I've never dated anyone outside my religion. I said, I could never marry a non-Catholic. And he went, wait a minute. I was baptized Catholic. I said, okay. So we got married in the Catholic Church because, well, suddenly the thought crossed my mind that it was, you know, a good idea to tell my now husband that I was, you know, not able to get pregnant. And we were, you know, dating, and we began to be sexually active, and he was concerned about that. And I said, oh no, I'm not. Because I saw on all my children that afternoon, you know, Erica Kane, she had a tipped uterus. A tipped uterus. I don't even know, and still don't know, what a tipped uterus is. But this is my thinking. I'm telling him what I saw on a soap opera that afternoon. Oh, don't worry about it. I have a tipped uterus. I can't get pregnant. Yeah. 8 weeks later. You're not going to believe it. He said, what happened to your tipped uterus? So I said, well, I'm pregnant. And I, you know, it's okay. My girlfriend from college, she's going out to California, and I'll just go with her. And he's sitting with me, and mind you, he's 23 years old. The man's a baby. I mean, I have two boys. I know what they were like at 23. And I can't believe that I you know, manipulated it so that he married me. He did. He was such a good man. He's still such a good man. But so this is my thinking, right? I gather information. It's not even mine. It's just a group of, you know, random thoughts, and this is how I end up, you know, in front of the priest, and we're getting married because I had a tipped uterus that I heard on all my children. So now I'm not only shallow, I'm a liar, and. You know, we're entering into this relationship, and when I look back and I think about the thoughts that crossed my mind, you know, to answer all these pieces about forming a relationship, forming a marriage, having children. I mean, and it gets worse. It didn't get better. So then, you know, when you have someone as unstable as I was, you know, the poor thing, he's not an alcoholic. He's really such a kind, straight shooter. But he's thinking that perhaps there's a problem with her, you know, because I was erratic and irrational. Because I stopped drinking, I had the baby, and then now we're, you know, in our first year of marriage, and I'm thinking, you know, it doesn't look good. You know, he's not really happy. But I want to make sure I have two children by the same father. And so we enroll in a natural family planning, NFP, program where I can learn how to regulate when I ovulate, right? So I'm not on the pill. I'm not doing anything that is against the church at this time. So, well, sort of. And so I'm charting myself, and it's going well, right? So I know when I ovulate. I know when I'm... it's a good time, you know, a safe time not to get pregnant. So I went over to my cousin's and, you know, we had a couple of glasses of wine. And I was telling her that things weren't really going that good. And I really wanted to have two babies by the same father. And then I, you know, my family would be complete. And I went home and I kind of batted my eyelashes and I, you know, and I said, oh, honey, you just look so good. And he said, I don't think that this is a good time, like on the chart. And I said, no, I think we're okay. And he says, no, I don't think it's a good time. And so then I began to cry. And I cried. And I just created this whole scene. And the next thing you know, we're being intimate. And he is just, you know, the poor thing. He's only 24 now, right? And he goes into the bathroom. He looks and he finds the chart and he comes in, he throws the chart at me. He said, you lied to me. And I said, I did. And this is my best thinking, that I entrapped this man again. And, you know, I'm happy as a clam. I am so happy. 6 weeks later, I get the pregnancy test and I knew it was going to be a boy. First one was a girl, second one was going to be a boy. And it was the best pregnancy. I was happy as a clam. And he said, you know, we have subsequently had conversations. And he said, you know, I was thinking about, you know, ending the marriage because you were crazy, you know. And he said, but it's easy to leave when there's just one baby. But how do you leave when there's two? And he thought, well, maybe she'll get better. And, you know, it got better for a little bit, but I nursed Mark, and I was really, you know, just two was all I was going to have. And then the next thing I know, I'm sitting with the doctor, and I said, you know, this NFP isn't going to work. And he said, well, I have another form of birth control. He said, you'll probably get your period after you stop nursing, and you'll be fine. Take the pill on the Sunday. And I never got my period. I was pregnant with baby number three. What do we do? It wasn't in my plan. And the poor guy, he's like, three? We're in an apartment on the third floor in Everett. What are we going to do? So what my sponsor had me do was begin to really look at my thinking and my judgment. And this is Mary on self-reliance. So she's preparing me for, you know, what we're going to learn about in the fourth step about self-reliance. I had no idea what self-reliance was. And I would have told you that I was, you know, a rock and rolling, you know, I was in the charismatic renewal, I was going to prayer meetings, and, you know, I had this rocking relationship with God. And, you know, it was just on the surface, you know, like suddenly the thought crossed my mind that it would be a good idea. And so I went to the prayer meeting. I did all these things, and there was no substance. Nothing took root. And so when I was with her, and we began to look at came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, I had to really meet, you know, face to face what my insanity looked like. And like I said, she was so kind and she was so forthcoming with her own examples, you know, and my examples were light compared to hers. So I felt, you know, that I could share all of this, and that's how God works, huh? God puts you with someone that puts you at ease and gives you permission to just be authentic. And I was able to tell her these things like no one ever knew any of these things, and so she said, Mary, are you willing to kind of put aside your relationship that you kind of designed in your head about who God is? And it's so funny, that picture of Jesus, that's the one that I had, and my husband called it the California Jesus. And I had a relationship with Jesus, this California Jesus, like I had with other men, you know? Like, I'll do this if you do that, you know, which got me in trouble my whole life, right? But that's what the kind of relationship it was. It wasn't a reverent relationship. It wasn't a relationship of Father, Son, Holy Spirit. It wasn't that kind of relationship. It was, what can you do for me? And she said, I want you to just set it aside. And have you ever read the Set Aside Prayer? It's pretty awesome. So you're just going to set aside what you know, and we're going to begin to be introduced to a God that is bigger than, greater than anything you've ever experienced. And so it wasn't in church, it wasn't in therapy, it wasn't anywhere else but in Alcoholics Anonymous that I began to come face to face with this incredible God who was going to transform me, who was going to recreate me, who was going to give me an opportunity to let go of the past and be greeted, right, with the future. So, what happened was that I had an opportunity to begin to look at some of the ways that I was worshiping. And she wanted me to begin to look at all the prayers that were in the big book. And we're going to come up to some different names for God on page 62. So we weren't there yet. We were just beginning to look at who God was. And I said to her, okay. And at that time, my husband was, he had gone to, the Catholic Mass with me. And he said, Mary, I need fellowship. There's no fellowship in the church. And he said, and I want to worship as a family. Would it be okay if we went to the Congregational Church? And I said, sure, we'll try it, And so I was spending Sunday and then Wednesday, because they had a prayer meeting, and then I began to do service. And this is what God began to do for me. He began to implement ways for me to see him in a different light. And I was open, because I gave God permission to come in, Like she said, would you give God permission to come in and show himself? And so I began to see how the changes came in when I began to let go. And once I began to let go, he revealed himself through people and through books and through situations. And that's going to be kind of my story, is whenever God wants to show me something, he's going to put a person, a book, or both into my life. And the training began when I sat with her and we were doing, step two. And I did come to believe. And I'll end with this. There was a woman who was going to the big book meeting in West Newbury, and she was sharing her experience with her God. So it was either on step 3 or step 11, I can't remember. And it was incredible. She said that her God was a breath away. And she put her hand up and she spoke and she said, this is how close her God was. And she described a God that was intimate in a way that was sensual that I had never heard about. And I went to her and I said, I want what you have. And she said, all you have to do is ask. And so I remembered, I'd walk around and I'd say, God. And he became a breath away. And that to me was incredible, that I had been in the church, I had been at prayer meetings, and I had been, you know, at all these things growing up. And it was in an AA meeting that I heard the most sensual thing about our Creator, that he's a breath away. And that's my experience with step 2. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. All right, my name is George. I'm still an alcoholic. Step 2, came to believe in a power greater than ourselves. Could restore us to sanity. Most big book meetings, lift that up into 2 meetings. So I'll flip-flop this a little bit. Restore to sanity. I took that part of that. When I discussed this step with my sponsor, I kind of took that on blind faith. I said, I'm not crazy. Come on. I don't want to jump off the bridge. I don't want to hurt anybody. And so he's very, very bright, and he says to me, well, you know, he says, would you at least be willing, and then he takes out a dictionary and says, insanity, not of sound mind. And then he says, now, would you be willing to at least admit that some of the escapades that you've been telling me about, would you at least be willing to admit that's not of sound mind? And I said, all right, I'll buy that, you know. So we set the hook with that. Although I do think that I have that at the time I had a touch of being a sociopath, and the definition of that is inappropriate social behavior, also with no conscience. And I think back about, you know, some of the things that I was doing when I was drinking and had absolutely no conscience. And I think that there was a touch of being a sociopath, that alcoholism had brought me to that kind of a situation, you know. So anyway, again, it's a big, broad room of interpretation for these steps, you know, for early part of the steps. And it wasn't until I got into my 4th step that I really started to see the insanity of my life. And not to get too far down the road, but, you know, when I'm reading my 4th step, I'm like having an out-of-body experience. I'm saying, who is this guy, you know? And it was me, obviously. And so the second part of the 2nd step really came into view with me when I wrote my 4th step. But I did go through the reading, and I took it on blind faith. And then the first part of the 2nd step, come to believe in a power greater than ourselves. Again, I took that part of the first part of the 2nd step on blind faith. I was a seeker when I got to this part of the step. I was going to church every day. I was reading inspirational books. I was watching Channel 2 metaphysical specials at 2:00 in the morning, inspirational books. I was looking for this big bang. I was looking for this white light experience, and then I was, you know, baptized in Episcopalian. It says, you know, childhood, you know, ideas, and I thought that God was like some guy, you know, with a beard and a robe and, you know, up in the Big Dipper somewhere. And, you know, when you get to heaven, you're at the pearly gates. I mean, that's what I was taught when I was a kid, you know. And you're kind of like on your own until you get there. So that's the way I live my life. And so, again, I always thought that this higher power, coming to believe in that, was this outer, it was a duality. I never thought of it as being a union, a oneness, you know. And again, I mentioned the dog whistle. I heard it again reading where it says, we find the great reality deep down within us. Only there can it be found. And then the God of my understanding, I did like a 180-degree turn, And I, that was the last place I ever looked. It was deep within myself, you know. And so there was a guy that used to come to the meeting, and he used to wear this T-shirt. God's the answer. What's the question? You know. And I always liked this, if I can find it. Dr. Carl Jung, the noted psychiatrist in the world, right? And this guy, Roland Hazard, comes to see him. Roland Hazard, I believe his father was a senator from Rhode Island. He's got the resources to go to Switzerland. It'd be like going to Steve Jobs and asking him to reset your iPhone, you know? So anyway, Jung is telling him, he says, I've never seen anybody, an alcoholic ever recover. He says, once in a while, there's these, you know, he says, there's no exception. He says, once in a while, there appear to be huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas and emotions and attitudes were once the guiding force, and these people are suddenly cast out. Well, how is that going to happen? Suddenly is a relative word. I mean, the planet's been here 4.5 billion years. So what is suddenly, a million, or is it a day or whatever? So anyway, the rearrangement is what had to happen later on in these steps. But it was at least the start for me when I read, you know, we find the great reality deep down within ourselves. Then I said, wait a second, this is starting to make sense. And the 12 steps, obviously, are a journey that we go deep within ourselves to find this source that she's talking about. And also coming to believe, you know, I my higher power I choose to call God, but it's many different society, you know, they call it the chi, the prana, the great spirit, the Christ. There's many, many names for it, but it does exist. And they talk about the prosaic girder. There's order even in a piece of steel, you know. And I think Einstein also said that the more they look to find that there is no higher power, the more they find it. They keep going down deep within the atom, and they find there's energy there, and we are 99.9% energy. So what is it then? And there's a force, there's an intelligence. Call it love, call it goodness, wisdom. I don't know. It's too big for my brain to comprehend. But it was in this part of the book is when my attitude changed, and I came to believe in a power greater than myself did exist. I didn't have the oneness, the distance between my brain and my heart. That did not come till much later. But it was in this step that I started to comprehend there was something out there or in me that I could access, and it was these 12 steps that was going to do it. And you know, I in the early years, and still do, you know, I really well-intended spiritual teachers. You know, you hear them on TV and books, and they all tell you about living a spiritual life and trusting in God, but nobody tells you how to get there. And this is the only place that I know where there are clear-cut directions of how to have that happen. I'm eternally grateful for that. I believe, you know, I don't want to mention any inspirational teachers and writers, but maybe in a private moment we could. But they didn't tell you how. They don't give you the directions. And it's in this book that we're fortunate enough to have clear-cut directions. The steps are numbered for a reason. I don't believe that they're to be jumped ahead. They build one on top of the other. And that's my experience with coming to believe. It didn't come till much later. And the insanity, I didn't really see the clear-cut insanity until I was well into my fourth step. And as we get further down the road, these steps, there's really more to bite into, you know. There's some direction, there's some things that we do that are a lot easier to talk about. So anyway, that's my experience with step two. And I hope we're on time, right? We're moving right along. Okay. Thank you.